You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Patrick McDowell graduated from University of the Pacific in 1981. He has been a foreign correspondent for most of the past 35 years. He's based now in Jakarta, Indonesia, and he is the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. He's made a trip back to the Bay Area this month. Tomorrow at 6 p.m., he will be speaking at UOP. This is a free and open to the public talk. It's titled The Asian Century. Patrick is on the phone with us right now. Hi, Patrick. Glad to have you with us on Insight.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here.
You live now in a dangerous part of the world. Can you tell me what the fears of ISIS are in Indonesia?
I wouldn't want to overstate the dangers, but we are on a kind of an upswing, I think, in terms of concerns over terrorism, largely because of ISIS and the way it has managed to spread its propaganda and its sort of influence around the world in the last couple of years. Indonesia, where I live, is the largest Muslim country in the world. There's 250 million people living there.
Wow.
And there's always been a kind of an undercurrent of extreme groups there, even though the basic religion there is quite moderate. And ISIS has tapped into that, as it has in many other places, by attracting Indonesians to its bases in Syria. And there are now hundreds of Asians in the Middle East. We don't hear about them very often. But the concern of the governments in Indonesia and neighboring countries is that when these people become, you know, quite battle-hardened and know how to use weapons and bombs and can kind of replenish the terrorist capacity of Southeast Asia, they'll be coming home and wreaking havoc. So last month, we had an attack inspired by an ISIS figure who's in Indonesia now, working with local militants to stage the biggest terrorism attack in Jakarta in many years. Fortunately, they didn't have many weapons, but they attacked a Starbucks. Four civilians were killed. The Indonesian police responded very quickly and killed the four attackers. But it has woken people up to the fact that we're in a resurgent terrorism time that we haven't really seen since the early 2000s.
An incident like that brings what much of the world's attention is, which is on ISIS in the Middle East, to Indonesia. But other than that, how engaged do you believe the U.S. is in Southeast Asia? And I guess we should talk about China specifically.
You really can't talk about Asia without meaning China these days. China has been just the dominant force in, you know, global politics in this part of the country since 2000. China's recent assertions of power in Southeast Asia have really left the governments here very rattled. In the early 2000s, China was very happy to make lots of trade agreements, fund infrastructure projects, and, you know, talk about its peaceful rise as a world power. And the Southeast Asian countries, who are all smaller and neighbors of China, were very happy to get that kind of attention and open those kinds of relationships with China. And it's turned a bit in the last 4 or 5 years, and that's accelerated very much under the current president of China, Xi Jinping, to a more aggressive use of China's military to assert its territorial claims, and especially in the South China Sea, which is an odd body of water that is at once a sea but essentially a maritime passage for much of the world's oil and other goods from the Middle East and Africa and other parts of Asia, from India through the Malacca Straits around Singapore and up through this passage of water. Everybody claims bits of this sea. And when all the countries claiming it were sort of weak and not really doing much to enforce those claims, that was fine. Ships passed through there very easily. But China has really stamped on its claims that it has a right to the entire South China Sea. And it's building artificial islands where none existed before. Some of them have airstrips that could be militarized very quickly. And this has gotten the governments in the region very nervous, and it's gotten Washington very nervous. And I think what we're seeing now is this issue is starting to play out a lot more. The Obama administration in the last 3 months has twice sent U.S. warships, you know, flying the flag very obviously, through territorial waters that China claims based on these artificial islands it's constructed. China expresses outrage. The U.S. says it's enforcing the right of freedom of navigation. And to the Americans and all of their allies in the region, this is very important, that China doesn't have the right to block free passage of these seas. On another level, China is using the economic influence that it has, again, to try and divide these smaller countries against each other, so they are, you know, prevented from taking unified stand. And the Obama administration, again, is trying to kind of coalesce them into a stronger group that can, you know, face up to this new challenge.
You're talking about very current shifting circumstances right now. Let's step back just a little bit in time to last summer when the Chinese stock market crashed, and it created a whole different shift in world economics. Has the U.S., in your opinion, missed an opportunity along the way to be more engaged and maybe be more prepared for some of these events that are happening, partly because there was so much focus on the Middle East and ISIS?
I think the U.S. actually is doing a decent job of reacting to the more contextual concerns, like China's position as it's evolving. And I'm not quite so sure that it can be reacting to the market eruptions of the day. China has been moving very quickly, and its economy is moving very quickly. I don't know that the U.S. can really keep up with that, but I do think that probably for much of the early Obama presidency, attention was paid to China, but the programs kept getting distracted. There has been the constant desire to, you know, try and, you know, solve the Middle East, and Obama has been pulling away from that a bit. Now Russia is resurgent, and the security of Europe suddenly is under question. These things do take a bit of focus off the ball, but Kerry and the Chinese diplomats meet quite often. These are not actually the most friendly of meetings. They're very professional and businesslike. With China, you're actually dealing with a functioning government that has ministries and a foreign policy and can be dealt with. But I do think that really since 2000, including in the Bush administration especially, the focus was pulled off of Asia, much to the detriment of U.S. interests out here. And we are now kind of in a phase where a lot of catch-up work and repair work has to be done. These kind of come to a point when you see the extreme tensions now between China and Japan, which I think alarms some people. The Japanese have become more assertive in their own right as they fear China's rising power next door. And, of course, the Americans and the Japanese have a long alliance. And Japan will take a bigger role, I think, in the region. But the sort of extreme nationalism that we see in China these days is it's worrying. It's going to get worse, I think, under Xi Jinping, who has another 8 years to run on his presidency. And while I think Obama has handled it well, I'm not sure that any of the candidates that are running now, apart possibly from Clinton, who is Secretary of State, seems to really grasp the measure of this. China did not figure in any of the Republican debates I've seen, and it's really been absent from the conversation of this election campaign. But I would argue that America's interests are really vitally linked to what goes on in this region over the next 25 years.
You're listening to Patrick McDowell. He is the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. He will be on the campus of UOP tomorrow. He's speaking at 6 o'clock in the DeRosa University Center, Ballroom B. And Patrick, you're back in the Bay Area visiting family. I don't think you return very often, but let me ask, from the view that you have over there, how much is the process of the election of a new U.S. president being watched, and how much is known candidate to candidate if you're not a journalist?
Everybody is aware of Donald Trump. He has thrust his way into the international stage through his campaign, I think, in a very big way. I have found that over the years that people in other countries are usually they're a lot more aware of what's happening in U.S. politics, and including the election process, than we are, as Americans, are aware of what's going on with most of them.
And Patrick, how much access do you have as a journalist there to meetings? You mentioned if Secretary Kerry is there at a meeting, perhaps you've got a U.S. pathway in. But is the politics accessible?
It depends on the country and the kind of relationships you're building. In some places, it's quite accessible. Indonesia is a fair example. It was essentially a military dictatorship for 35 years until the dictator Suharto was overthrown in 1998. Now it's a very vibrant democracy with a very open press, and the foreign media benefits from that. Things are a little less scripted here than in a more kind of controlled communications context like you get in America, but I find that you go through waves of these things in different countries, and with China it's actually quite difficult. When I was an editor for Asia in my previous job, every time that we sent a reporter out in China from Beijing, he would end up getting arrested for 3 hours until we could straighten out, you know, his paperwork. So it varies. But
I want to note one story that you spent quite a bit of time covering, and that was the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. And you've been covering stories for, as I said, more than three decades. But put that one in the context of all of your experience.
Certainly the strangest one I've been on. It started off as a pretty standard air crash, a story that I've covered, you know, many times. And I think by the end of the second day, when the plane hadn't been found, we started having questions about it. But it wasn't until 4 days in that it became really apparent it hadn't gone anywhere near its intended flight path, or had deviated hugely from that flight path, and could have been lost in a vast swath of the world. And that, to me, was unprecedented. And I know that the speculation about what actually happened on the plane has been overwhelming, and the journal has tried to steer clear of most of those theories, to be honest, because it's hard to tell what they're founded upon. But I have a feeling that this is, you know, probably something we're never going to know the full story on. Utterly captivating event when you realize just how much information we get from every flight that goes up on Earth, and just how little we know about what happened with this one.
Well, I appreciate the time that you spent with us today. We're going to post a number of links, including, Patrick, a charming story with a picture of your mom's Thanksgiving turkey recipe and how you've taken that turkey recipe with you all over the world to keep the Thanksgiving tradition. It's really lovely.
It should have come a few months ago. It would have been better. But
I could smell the turkey through that story. Well, thank you so much. And again, I'll mention that your speech is tomorrow night at 6 o'clock back on your old college campus.
Thanks very much.
That's Patrick McDowell. He is the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal. There's more information at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio.